Accession number 4630, Reel 1.
Colonel Thomas, Reel 1. When did you become a prisoner of war, Colonel Thomas?
On the fall of Singapore, on the 15th of February, 1942.
Which unit were you with in Singapore?
Well, in the end, I was with an RASC MT company.
Had you received any official preparation for such a contingency?
Absolutely none at all, but it was pretty evident, I think, to all of us, particularly in that last week in Singapore, what the eventual outcome was going to be. I think perhaps at that time, earlier in the week, after the Japanese had landed on the Monday, complete sort of chaos ensued, certainly amongst the units which we were with, which contained a very large element and were dependent upon the local population. There was complete and utter chaos by the Tuesday, and I remember going down into Singapore on the Thursday night on a job, and I've never seen such confusion in all my life at the docks. There was RAF, Australians, British, everybody mooning around. The banks were destroying all their money. The order had been given to get rid of all the liquor and spirits, and all this was being broken in the bulk warehouses and places like that. And I'd never seen such chaos in all my life. And I think perhaps at that time, if someone said, well, you're going to be a prisoner of war, one would have been thankful, because the outlook seemed to be that it was going to be the end for most of us anyway.
So you said that you had anticipated that the Japanese takeover. Did you actually make any personal preparation for being a POW?
Absolutely none at all. No, I don't think it entered anyone's heads about it. Certainly, I'd never contemplated being a PW. It was the last thing in the world that I thought was going to happen to me anyway, being a professional soldier. And I don't think I could have contemplated it even. But on the, I've talked earlier about the Tuesday and the Thursday. On the Friday afternoon, it was pretty evident that the local population were not going to stand up to it at all, and that it was not going to be possible to solve the thing by fighting in the streets. The local population was too large, it was too concentrated. The water mains and things were bursting all over the place and spouting great spouts of water. The whole of the municipal services and things seemed to have collapsed entirely. There was hardly any burying of the dead or anything like that. And as I said, the water situation was obviously going to be a problem. And as the people were forced back into a smaller and smaller area, in a climate and with such a dense population like that, the whole thing was utterly chaotic, and one knew that the end was very, very near indeed.
What did the attitude of the local civilian population seem to be towards the coming of the Japanese?
Well, I think they accepted it. I think that they were to blame for a great deal of it. I'm afraid, didn't cooperate. In the last couple of weeks at all, it was absolutely impossible to get labor to move anything from A to B, and it was remarkable that after the Japanese came, the way that they did cooperate under force, certainly by mutual consent, they didn't cooperate in the last couple of weeks once they saw the way the wind was blowing. And I think that this not only hampered our forces, but I think that in the end, this was probably the main consideration of the general. The local civil population determined the whole issue in the end.
Could you describe the circumstances of your capture?
Well, mine were it was no capture at all, really. What happened was that the complete administration had broken down in those units which had got local military and labor, and we had finally come back to a house in Tanglin, just over the golf from the golf course where the Japanese came through, and we were with some federal volunteer armored car unit, and about a dozen of us British in this house, just waiting for somebody to come, for something to happen. We had a brigade major come round on the Friday morning, and he gave us some tasks should the Japanese come through where they expected them through, and where eventually they did. And I think the thing that I remember most from that, when we were in these positions, was the tremendous sort of fifth column and sniping from behind. I think that was worse than anything that we had from the front of us, from the Japanese. It was the fifth column. It absolutely amazed me and has intrigued me to this day. I'd read a lot about it in Europe, and I thought I knew something about it, but I didn't think that it was going to be like that. And obviously the Japanese had got a tremendous number of people in Singapore who were busily destroying things from the rear. So certainly morale.
So this was a Japanese fifth column?
I'm positive it was, yes. Yes. And on the Friday evening, an Australian battery came and parked themselves right down where we were, and they were firing away over open sights. I don't think there was no observed fire for anybody by that time. The whole thing was, everybody was doing exactly as they pleased. And on the Saturday afternoon, Singapore fell on the Sunday. On the Saturday afternoon, they'd gone down the road somewhere and got some booze from somewhere, and they had the most merrymaking carry-on I've ever seen. And they were very, very drunk, but they were a splendid gunner team, and they got loads and loads of ammunition. They got their ammunition carts there, and they went on firing and firing and firing, and I don't know what damage they did or what good they did, but however, they did their job. But on the Sunday at about 2 o'clock, a captain came round. I think he was from the Manchester Regiment, and we were in position then, just near the Tanglin golf course. We were supposed to lay an ambush and what have you there. We'd been given all these various orders. And he said, I think there's going to be a general stand down at 4 o'clock. Whether or not you'll get any detailed orders, I don't know, he said. But anyway, there will be a stand down at 4 o'clock. And sure enough, it went absolutely silent. And it was pretty obvious that things were over. We hadn't seen the Japanese in any force by this time. And the following morning, it was pretty obvious that things were drawing absolutely to a close. But the extraordinary thing was that this Australian battery went firing on and on and on all through the day. And when the word got round at about 4 o'clock, I think it was, on the Sunday afternoon, that it was all over, and everybody would stay where they were, absolutely, or else there'd be a hell of a lot of trouble with the Japanese. They still went on firing, and inevitably the Japanese eventually sorted them out and put over about, I think it was their usual 27 planes, and just knocked hell out of it and nearly finished a lot of us off, which was not a bad end to the situation as it was there, as far as we were concerned. At least somebody was having a go. It wasn't us, but these Aussies did. And I think they were knocked out in the end. And we were told to pile our arms and at a certain place. We didn't do anything about this because we didn't know where the place was. But however, on the Monday morning, and the boot was completely on the other foot, and before you could say Jack Robinson, the Japanese were in on us, and they sorted us out in no uncertain manner and took everything. We were in a very beautiful house. It was a terrible tragedy to see places like that where people had just walked out on the beautiful homes. And, of course, Japanese came in and took stuff immediately there and then, and it was pretty obvious what the nature of their forward troops was going to be. The slightest disobedience, they shot people, and that was that. And we stayed in that house until the Tuesday lunchtime, I think it was, when someone came round and said at 4 o'clock, you'll pick up exactly what you can and you'll form up down the road, you'll be marched into the town and you'll be marched to PW camp at Changi. And that's exactly what happened.
Did you see people being shot for disobedience?
No, I didn't. Not at that stage. No, I did not. But I'm absolutely certain that they were, and I know that they were shot for disobedience.
When you first came into contact with the Japanese, did they ask you for information of any kind about yourself?
None at all. Absolutely none at all. No, they were not terribly interested in us as individuals at that level. I don't know whether they were interested in higher ranks. They were not. I think there was a WO and a sergeant and about 12 or 14 troops. But although they were frontline troops, I think they were damn good soldiers. They were obviously completely bewildered as to how to deal with that situation. And the Europeans, I think, nonplussed them a bit. And the houses and the wealth and the general great conglomeration of equipment that there was around. I mean, on reflection, and having served in China for 3 or 4 years and having seen the Japanese up there, then obviously I think they were, it was absolutely stunned them, I think, the amount of tackle and stuff and goods and material things that were about.
What was the demeanor of the Japanese troops with whom you first came in contact? Were they elated?
Oh, very, very elated. Very, very elated, but they have this oriental sort of inscrutability about them. I think they realized absolutely that they'd won a tremendous prize and that they were, yes, they were absolutely elated, but they didn't show this an awful lot. I mean, they knew that they'd won a considerable prize and that there was going to be plenty of time to sit on it.
So they didn't crow over you as the vanquished?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No, I think there was the respect for, you know, soldiers to soldiers. Immediately at that stage, it was probably better at that stage than ever at any time later that I saw, anyway.
Did they take any personal possessions from you?
None at all. Absolutely nothing whatsoever. Absolutely nothing, and there was no need for them to. There was far too much stuff lying around everywhere for them to take. As I said earlier, the houses, particularly in that area, and there were hundreds of other houses, thousands of other houses like it in Singapore and shops and what have you. I mean, they were wide open to the Japanese soldiers. And obviously there was too much for them to cope with, and I would say that they were not really guilty of any looting or anything that I saw at that stage anyway. I mean, no, their bearing, I thought, was exceptional. I believe it was the Guards Division, which were the elite of the Japanese forces, which we encountered at that stage. and which had been put in, I think, to take Singapore. And as far as we were concerned, the soldiers, nothing very much happened, frightful happened, but when we marched to Changi, it was pretty obvious that in the 48 hours, a lot of frightful things had happened, because as we marched down through Orchard Road, down by the municipal buildings, there were all Chinese heads which had been cut off and hung on the various street lampposts and buildings as we went along. So they'd certainly got in on the Chinese population, and it was pretty obvious that they were going to deal, any rate at the start, more fiercely with them than they were with us. And we were more or less left to our own resources and to organize ourselves. And this was the way with Japanese guards, that we marched under our own steam with what we could pick up and carry to Changi.
Did you have much organization at this stage?
Absolutely none at all. Absolutely none at all. It was a question of forming up at a point and going off and not being left behind and not being with the crowd. I mean, the essence of what shall I say, organization at that time was merely follow the crowd and be with the crowd, and a sort of, what shall I say, a sort of safety in numbers.
So were the British officers not exercising authority at this stage?
Oh yes. I don't think that discipline ever broke down with the British forces before the war ended there. I probably a bit later on have something to say about the immediate effect of being placed in PW camp and what happened then, and it probably did break down. But up to that stage and during the whole of the war and up to the capitulation, no, I think discipline was as good as it's ever been, and that the relationship between the officers and men was as good as it normally is in the British Army.
So what happened next after you'd been walking down the Orchard Road?
Well, we were marched to Changi, which was quite an ordeal, really, because there were a hell of a lot of people who hadn't slept and who were not fit, unfortunately, with heavy packs. It's probably an indictment of our training. There were a lot of people who were in completely administrative jobs and that, although they were in uniform, and it found a lot of people out. And this is where the first inkling of being a prisoner came to one, because the Japanese soldiers, they were fit enough, and they were prepared to march the 20-odd miles, whichever, I've forgotten what the actual distance is to Changi. But it was a pretty awful operation altogether, because people had obviously picked up as much as they could carry. God knows what some of them were going to do with these things. However, they had to abandon them and eventually get on with getting to Changi. I mean, that was the main thing. And any stragglers, I mean, were dealt with very forcibly by the Japanese. And they were not prepared to tolerate stragglers anyway. And some were left. God knows what happened to them. And they looked pretty ghastly, one or two that I saw. But however, there was nothing one could do about it. The object was to get to Changi and see what happened there.
What did happen there?
Well, when we got to Changi, we were put into the... there were lots of people put in the prison. The rest of the people were put in the area around the prison. And we were just dumped down and told to get on with it. And there was a house. I went into a house that was nearby where I fetched up, and there were about 20 people in this house. It was an old officer's married quarter. There were beds and things in there. The first in got those. There were pots and pans and what have you. It was an amazing situation, really. Anyway, I managed to get a bed in a small room by the kitchen, and there were one or two bits and pieces there, and people had brought one or two bits and pieces, and what did the people do? They immediately began to make themselves comfortable, an extraordinary situation, really, and tried to make cups of tea and what have you. And we managed to exist like this for 2 or 3 days. And then, of course, discipline did break down, because it was pretty obvious that, all right, we went into a house where there were one or two things. Perhaps there was some tea and a few tinned vegetables and things like this. And one could exist, and the people had brought one or two things, but where you'd got a solid block of chaps who probably hadn't carried very much, and there wasn't anything in the shed or the house where they were, well then, they wanted to provide for themselves, and the law of the jungle began to operate. And it did operate for quite some time, and it was pretty frightful. The chaos was inevitable, of course. The Japanese didn't care. They'd just thrown us there and left us to our own resources. And then chaps began to break out of the wire, which had been put round at the back of the camp by this time in Changi. And all kinds of trouble started then, of course. They got in with the local population. The local Japanese shot the local population. They shot quite a few of our chaps. And as I said earlier, the law of the jungle operated, certainly where I was, for a fortnight at least. In this period, unfortunately, I got dengue fever, and I just lay down and didn't give a damn about anybody or anything. There was no medical attention. And I think I must have been like that for about a week, in a pretty bad fever. And I recovered. The incredible thing about dengue was it's a sandfly fever. It had, I understood from the medicos, no mortality rate before the war, but in PW camp it had a very high mortality rate, an incredible thing. However, I didn't die from it, and I managed to get myself together, and I think this must have been anything from 10 days to a fortnight that this had all happened, and I'd been pretty well out of circulation and didn't give a damn about anything. And by this time, General Percival had got things organized, and people had gone round. He'd got all his staff officers together, and people had gone round and said where officers hadn't got any badges of rank up. Oh, the Japanese had taken stripped us of a lot of badges of rank. Where officers hadn't got, or NCOs or WOs hadn't got badges of rank, they would print or paint them or do something. And everybody ridiculed this and were quite scornful about it. But the experience in the end was that this was absolutely the right thing to do, and it was done as quickly as I think General Percival thought about it and organized it, and it was one of the best things that he did, because from then on we carried on under British Army rules, at least internally amongst ourselves, and I think that this saved the whole situation. And of course one has heard about, I heard later there were courts martial and what have you, and whilst they would all seem terribly farcical in a PW camp, I'm positive that there was probably a good reason about them. They probably thought it a good thing to hold those kind of disciplinary courts to keep the thing together. And I think that was one of the best things that was done. And obviously it was possible under those conditions, with so many of us, to begin organizing quite a few other things. And they were getting lists of people with various qualifications and that, lecturers and what have you, teachers and what have you, to try and do something for the troops in subjects in which they were interested in that. And it was certainly in my time in Changi possible to hold these gatherings, and I even myself uniquely, I think in about July, attended a Masonic meeting, if you please. And whilst we did get a cry of cravens, and the Japanese got very near and we had to pack it all in, I think it was rather a unique experience. But does, I think, show typically what the situation was. The food, of course, was the biggest factor there, and this was gathered together under one command and was dished out as fairly as possible. Earlier, of course, it wasn't a bad ration there. There was a hell of a lot of food in Singapore. But by comparison to what we'd enjoyed before being PWs, of course, it was minute. But and then again, in comparison to what we had later when we moved out of Changi, it was still a feast.
So what did the food consist of?
Well, the food consisted of rice and any tin goods that people could get hold of. The Australians were the most ingenious, I think, with food and the sort of camp conditions. There was obviously a lot of going to be a lot of insanitary conditions, and the Australians had got augers for boreholes, and they dug the most fantastic boreholes and stuck seats on top of them and had blowpipes and things in them, and they had old converted bicycles to polish to deal with polished rice. Polished rice is not a very nice thing to eat. It certainly contains the vitamins. The skin contains the vitamins, and you rub them all away. But it's like this awful brown bread that you sometimes get that people can't stand. And whereas English people like white bread, I'm positive they like white rice too. And the Australians were very ingenious at things like this, and they did the most fantastic things. They we used to go out in the morning, an order went out that everybody, people were having various delicacies and dishes. We had a lot of the local people there. There were certain fruits and things that they knew that we could eat, which they wouldn't have eaten before the war, but they were quite safe to eat. We used to go out and collect snails and things from their hedges. They knew the time to go out and get those. And then, of course, the Australians started handing theirs into the hospital, so everybody did, and this kept the chaps alive in the hospital. They were most ingenious with the manufacture of limbs and things for all the sick and wounded who'd been brought in by this time into the camp. The Japanese tossed them all in there and left them. And they were absolutely magnificent in their ingenious ideas for coping with this style of living. Later, having served in Australia, one could see that that they had this facility, I think, because they were more resourceful and lived out in the bush and out in the extreme climate. And sort of basic conditions, and then probably the townspeople and the regiments and people that we had serving in Malaya at the time.